It's a pleasure to be here. This is a co-presentation, we have Hiram Sarabia will follow me. I agreed to set the stage, provide a little context, and Paula is here as well. So maybe at the end, if there are questions, all three of us could chime in, and Hiram and I will split the time doing this. I wanted to say just a couple of words about our Superfund program, funded by the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences. This is really an interesting agency in the sense that the NIEHS has this Superfund basic research program that is supposed to generate science for helping clean up our Superfund sites. It's not the same thing as the EPA Superfund program. It's a science-based program. I'm sure everybody in here probably knows that. But they have recently mandated the creation of a research translation core, which is new, starting in 2005. They've long had a community outreach core, but the research translation core is new. And a lot of what Hiram and I have been doing has been funded through this express effort to link science to society with the express purpose of creating science that's useful in cleaning up hazardous waste sites. So we have no financial interests in this. This is the Superfund website. And for those of you who took the tour yesterday, if you go to superfund.ucsd.edu, you can see some of the pictures from the tour that we took yesterday. There's a lot of really good information on this site. And what we'll be sharing with you today is a project that Hiram and I are doing with partners focused on tribes. I mentioned that the NIEHS mandated two cores. This is the research translation core that we have, and I won't read all these all this information. We'd be happy to provide any of this information to anybody that wants it. But basically building partnerships, transferring the knowledge that's generated, facilitating communication, and collaboration. Now, the research translation core includes tribes as just one partner among many. It's the second core that we have that really focuses on tribal organizations. And that's where you're going to hear Hiram talk about reducing toxicants on tribal lands and the work that Paula is doing as well. When you create an outreach core for the grant, when you're writing the grant proposal, you have to specify a vulnerable population. So we chose tribes because none of the other 15 programs nationwide that are working with vulnerable populations have selected tribes. And we figured tribes are very important. And if you were to look at what's going on with tribes, it's very interesting. In the Pacific Southwest, that is to say EPA Region 9, 97% of the tribes now have, 97% of the 147 tribes, federally recognized tribes, in EPA Region 9, that's the Pacific Southwest, which is what, California, Arizona, Nevada, and so in that region, 97% of them now have environmental protection agencies. 10 years ago, only 7% had environmental protection agencies. So naturally, that creates a demand for science. But what kind of science? And as we quickly discovered in working with tribes, that there's kind of Western science and there's also traditional tribal life ways, traditional ecological knowledge, and other elements that tribes don't fully reject Western science, but there's a real concern about tribes being recognized for having a certain sort of wisdom and other types of ways of thinking about science. So for instance, at a very interesting EPA risk assessors meeting where there were tribes present, we saw the argument for the precautionary principle. We saw the argument for moving risk assessment from a disease paradigm to a wellness paradigm. So there's a lot to be had in this interaction with tribes. Now, San Diego, just setting the stage a little bit further for Hiram, who's about to follow. San Diego, the county of San Diego, is one of the highest densities of tribes anywhere in the country. It is the highest, actually. There are 18. Native American reservations with 17 federally recognized tribes occupying 4% of the land surface in San Diego County. So that's quite high. If you were to look at a map, and I actually did bring some pretty interesting maps here. If anybody wants to see these, I can make these available. There's one that I wanted to show you here in terms of maps, because we're very sensitive to working with tribes in a way where we're conscious of co-producing knowledge with the tribes. We're not about to make the mistake of going in there as the know-it-alls who are going to come save the day on tribal lands. Far be it. Far be it. I mean, if so one of the things that we've done with respect to empowering tribes through our community outreach corps and through the research translation corps that I mentioned earlier is develop visualization tools, planning and decision support tools and visualization tools. And when we were creating a, I don't have a slide of this, but this is an image of a model that we created, which is basically the largest Southern California, Northern Baja California region. It's really quite exquisite. I wish I could have brought it in here. It's about twice the size of that table there, and the mountains are about 3 inches high, and it's a 3D kind of a solid terrain 3D model. And when we were deciding what parameters to make on that, we consulted with the tribes, and thanks to them, we actually lowered the lat-long dimensions on this far enough south to include the historical Kumaye Indian boundaries. So there was an interaction along those lines, and then Mike Connolly of the Campo Indian Reservation was able to use that, you know, stunning graphical image to then overlay historically where the tribes had been located in that area. So we don't, you know, just a couple other vignettes, and then I'm going to go on to the last slide that I have here. This research translation, again, trying to be sensitive when working with tribes in these areas. If there's any sense that they're guinea pigs for any new technology or something, like we had some interesting meetings at the outset where Hidam and I are both very excited about some of these new biomolecular technologies that we have to do sampling. And phytoremediation, Julian Schroeder's lab has got plants that can hyperaccumulate heavy metals out of soil. And we knew that tribes had historically had an understanding of the role that poplar trees and things can do in cleansing water, keeping the wetlands clean, keeping their water supply clean. But when we mention these tools, we're not going to be your guinea pigs, young man, as excited as you might be with these technologies. So of course not, you know. So there's got to be an interaction, and maybe you'll talk a little bit about this in our relationship with the 29 Palms Tribal Science Lab. We actually did a transfer agreement with UCSD and the Tribal Science Lab, where they now have all the equipment that they need to use these new biomolecular tools, this particular bioassay in the lab, and you know, we work with them with the equipment and the training to try to make use of that. So that's where we're going with that. Now, this is my last slide, and I just wanted to set the stage a little bit. I mean, my background in this is urban and regional planning. I have a PhD from UCLA in the planning. So it's like, and I'm working close with environmental scientists, and Hidam and I have a wonderful working relationship. He's an environmental scientist, and I'm the one on the team that tries to put the linkage from science to society in the context of what we call regional ecology. And there's four things I just want to tick off quickly, because I think ultimately to do a good job in linking science to society and working with tribes or working with low-income communities along the border, as we're doing, that you have to go global in this world, in this day and age. And so we're working with this notion of promoting regional ecology. And the four things that are going on, up in the left, the globalization of human environmental interactions, risks, and disasters. I mean, there's no getting around the fact that we live in an increasingly globalized world, like even the air pollution. There's people at UCSD that are documenting a 1,000-mile long, 300-meter deep atmospheric brown cloud coming from the burning of a biomass in Asia, coming to the California coast in 4.2 days. But the risks, global climate change, and what's happening with the risk we face with the rise of sea levels and so forth. So, and disasters, increasingly strong storms, things like that, but globalization of disease vectors, all of that. So as much as we might want to focus in on the nitty-gritty at the local level, there has to be this global-mindedness and the capacity to factor that dimension into this, which, fortunately, the second thing that's going on And each of these things I'm pointing to here all go well for the kind of approach that we're trying to take, where we're embedding the projects that you're going to hear about in this global context. The second thing, new modes of knowledge production, communication, and networking. There's an awesome information and communications technology revolution taking place. And we have access to that at UCSD. Other places do as well around the country with these innovations. But at UCSD and the San Diego Supercomputer Center and Cal IT2 Squared, with these amazing technologies for visualization, data integration, and so forth, and communication networking with cloud computing and these other abilities to share tools in a federated way that enables greater integration and synergy across otherwise these knowledge silos and et cetera. So there's promising things happening there. The other thing that's going on, of course, are institutional stresses and societal push for change in the face of increasing complexity. So there is an increasing savvy among tribal organizations, among community groups and grassroots organizing, that they need to tap into transnational networks. And in case of tribes, maybe Paul at the end, one question you could comment on this is the networking among tribes, for instance, at the regional level with the Tribal Environmental Health Collaborative that I know you're creating, and what we're trying to do with indigenous tribes through the Center for Iberian and Latin American Studies, do networking among tribes at the scale of the South America, you know, and in Latin America. So that kind of networking is that there are groups with these institutional stresses being faced, savvy to these kinds of things. Finally, and I'll end with this, is that there is a culture change going on in our universities. And when you think about how to solve these problems, like I was wondering when you ended one of your first presentation with this observation that, and there's something we can do about this, you know, and then you have to wonder, well, what exactly can be done and how does that get mobilized and where's the agency going to come from for doing that? And I think research universities, particularly as fiscal crisis straps the state and as financial resources dry up and become more scarce, that research universities are going to be held more accountable to problem solving. And I like to think of the research university as becoming not so much an ivory tower anymore, which there's a critique of that a long time, or an ivory bridge even. This notion of somehow, you know, in an afterthought sort of way, connecting the great knowledge from the great university to the community, ivory bridge, that's okay, but going the next step and creating or thinking of our great universities as ivory gardens in which there are, you know, real, robust, collaborative relationships in place with the co-production of knowledge going on, and there's an effort to use the garden metaphor to cross-fertilize the kind of crops that are emerging in this environment. So this is what we're trying to do, and that's I turn it over to Idam now, where talk about a specific project. There we go.
Great, thank you. Well, thank you very much, Keith. What I would like to do now is give you specific examples of the different things that we've been working on. Working with tribes, as I've learned in the last few years that I've been working with Paula and others in the tribal communities, really presents unique challenges. And they are akin in some ways, because tribes are sovereign country nations, to working across borders. So the challenges that we face working with people in Mexico and trying to do some work in Mexico are not all that different from working with tribes. Having said that, we recognize that tribes, for a number of reasons, I'll try to outline some of them, really are vulnerable populations. So as Keith mentioned, we're in a very interesting position because we're essentially a bridge between the basic researchers in the lab that are trying to further our understanding of the molecular mechanisms by which toxicants affect cells, affect tissues, affect organisms, and the community with the problems. So we're in a very unique position to bring in new knowledge and new technologies to bear. And we focus in two particular areas, the U.S.-Mexico border. Some of you joined us. Thank you. We had a great time during the tour yesterday. And also, I wish we could have done a tour with one of the tribal communities that we work with here in San Diego. So let me see if I can. There we go. So let's begin about talking a little bit about what environmental issues and concerns we're dealing with. As you might imagine, and also because of historical marginalization that a lot of communities have experienced, there is a very significant lag, even in the United States today, in infrastructure. And I'm talking about drinking water infrastructure, about sewage infrastructure, about solid waste infrastructure. And that creates, in and of itself, certain environmental risks that make tribes more vulnerable to exposure to environmental toxicants. The other aspect that's really interesting for us and is the exposures that can arise from tribal lifestyles and traditional practices. And to cite a couple of examples that really illustrate why exposures for tribal people are not, you can use the same models for tribal people as you would for the bulk of the population. One example is the repatriation of ceremonial artifacts or items back to the tribes. In the past, a lot of ceremonial items were removed from tribal land, preserved in museums with arsenic and other toxic materials, and then returned to the tribes. So now when these items return to the tribes, when you begin a meeting, a tribal meeting, you always begin with a ceremony, and these items are being handled and passed around. People are drinking out of them, maybe. That's a route of exposure that you would not expect to see in an urban lifestyle, for example. Similarly, if you look at the Pacific Northwest and you look at fish consumption, most people in an urban lifestyle, they might eat a lot of fish, but they might eat it a few times a year or maybe once a month at that. In some of the communities, tribal communities, the bulk of the protein intake might come from fish. And fish might also have as a food item a certain cultural significance and importance. So there are potential routes of exposure that are associated with tribal lifestyles and cultural practices. The other really significant source of vulnerability for tribes is the vulnerability that stems from the fact that they're sovereign nations, that they have to provide services for their own communities, that they have to have their own tribal EPA, and that the people in the tribal EPA need to have the knowledge and the training to be able to identify, prioritize, and address environmental health concerns. So oftentimes what we see is what Keith was mentioning, that a few years ago, a lot of tribes didn't even have tribal EPAs. And now that they do, a lot of the training of the people that work in tribal EPAs is mostly on the environmental side of things, not so much on the environmental health side of things. And in addition to that, of course, there is a significant source of vulnerability that stems from a tribe's ability to regulate the activities that cause pollution on their land. So I was talking earlier to Paula, and we're talking about the importance of the tribal court system, that a tribe might or might not have regulations in place, but even if they do have those regulations in place, enforcing those regulations might be complicated if they don't have a tribal court system. A lot of the things that I'm talking about really relate back to resources, and so to how many or whether the tribe has financial resources and whether the tribe is well organized. And those are factors that really play into how vulnerable an indigenous community is. The more resources, the more vulnerable you become, and the more organized, of course, the less these problems become major issues. So just to show you a couple of pictures here, we have a really remote community on the top right-hand corner in Baja, where they don't have any drinking water infrastructure. Basically, their infrastructure is this plastic barrel right there that's being used for storing groundwater. We also have issues in Baja with handling of solid waste. So there's a lot of trash burning. There's issues on this side of the border also with people driving right up to the reservation land and dumping things there, just because they know that the tribe doesn't have the capacity to patrol their borders, etc. So there are interesting differences between the U.S. and Baja in terms of what the issues are with toxicant exposure. I would say that in Mexico, a lot of the issues related to toxicant exposure, particularly in the more remote communities, relate back to, again, to the infrastructure. And so we would expect potential exposures happening through drinking of contaminated well water. Here in the U.S., industries operating near near tribal land, or in some cases in the middle of tribal land, also are a problem. And that also is an interesting situation where you might have an industry operating what is called tribal fee land. So these are parcels of land that were at one point sold for revenue, and they're now controlled and by other people, and so there might be operations there that the tribe really has a hard time regulating because of that unusual situation. And that's why a lot of when you look at maps of tribal lands, they look kind of a checkerboard like because of the situation with the fee land in some cases.
Okay. 2 minutes. Okay.
Well, I'm going to have to fly through some of these. What I want to get, the point that I want to get across is we are now facing a really difficult situation where we've been working on these efforts for a number of years. We're running out of resources. Some of these efforts are being stalled or slowing down, again, because of the lack of resources to continue this work. We rely on a network of networks. That's the way to work, irregardless of whether you have the resources that you need or not. But we reach out to a lot of people. Keith covered some of the history. It's interesting to note that there are historical links between the tribes in the U.S. and Mexico. There are bloodlines. These people, the people in the tribes are related. They share a common culture. They share a language in some cases. In some cases, they share lifestyles, and that becomes significant because of what I mentioned before with respect to exposures. I want to just touch upon a couple of specific examples of work that we've done. We've worked trying to approach this problem of tribal exposures through access to information. It's great if you can develop Google Earth applications, but for a tribe that doesn't have electricity, it doesn't help them. So the point is here that tribes have a right to know. Access to the internet is not just a neat thing. It could be something that could help a community make better decisions. And a lot more work needs to be done to really reach those communities that, particularly in Mexico, that don't have access to these types of to this type of infrastructure. The one thing I wanted to talk about briefly here is when we're talking about transferring technologies to tribes, we've been successful in transferring this P450 human reporter gene system to 29 Palms, which is a very sophisticated, very unusual, very sophisticated tribal EPA. The guy who runs it has a molecular biology degree from UCLA, a PhD. His lab is already set up as a biomolecular lab. And the lesson to be learned here, they were able to do this because of the funding and support that they got through different government grants, including EPA. If they hadn't had this set up already, we wouldn't have been able to transfer any of this to them. And the importance of doing this is that tribes trust other tribes, and they then become a capacity builder for other tribes if we're able to enable them in this way. We are connected not just, of course, to our own program here in San Diego, but to a national network of programs. There are literally hundreds of research projects out there waiting to be deployed and used. But we can't do that unless there exists already some sort of institutional capacity at the tribe. So more incentives need to be available to really encourage talented scientists and develop the infrastructure needed so that tribes can take advantage, just like everybody else, of the new technologies that are coming online. This is something that Paula has built over the last few years. I think this, unlike the other things that we've worked on, this is really organic. This is on the ground. This is community-based. This is an effort to build capacity of tribes to identify, prioritize, and address environmental health issues. Again, a lot of people that work in the tribal EPAs are not really familiar with environmental health, so this becomes a training grounds for them to really understand what the issues are and really be able to walk around in their community and identify what things might be of concern. This was beginning to be formalized around the time of the fires, And it was interesting to see how this coalition of tribes, universities, and some government agencies could really mobilize quickly to provide a complementary assistance to what the government was already doing. So we were able to maintain a constant line of communication with the tribes that were impacted. This is some maps that we generated during the fires. The purple is tribal land. The dark right there is the burned area. There's a tribe there that had 90% of its land completely destroyed by the fire. And there's two of them, actually, Rincon and La Jolla. And so this effort, I really am very excited about, because it's allowing us to build those trust relationships and communication lines with tribes that will allow us, hopefully in the near future, to get on the ground and actually use some of these technologies. And a lot of the things that we have, people don't necessarily need to feel afraid of them, because they don't involve using people to test anything in particular. They're just new ways of measuring things and new ways that could really be significant in reducing human health effects and environmental effects. Okay, so I'm just going to finish with this slide in Baja again. The problems that we see for a lot of rural communities are tied to their drinking water, to how they handle waste, to what they do with their sewage. But as this region grows, you saw that picture of the urban sprawl earlier. Maybe 5-10 years from now, they'll be probably surrounded with houses and industry, and so it's a good time to also build capacity there for them to understand what those challenges are going to be in the future. But a lot remains to be done, and it's, I think the bottom line here is that there is a lack of environmental information, so a lot more needs to be researched to understand what the levels of toxicants in the environment are, what the potential routes of exposure are as well. Thank you.